Hello, and welcome to Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. I'm Jeremy Wartzman.
I'm Bianca Bremham.
And I'm Lara Chan Baker.
Jackie Winter Gives You the Business is a weekly podcast from the Jackie Winter Group, which is a creative production and representation studio based in Melbourne and New York City. Each week, our two offices come together to celebrate the people and processes that operate behind the scenes to make creative work happen, as well as some of the thoughts and tools that are shaping our industry. While we have a certain focus on advertising, illustration, and animation, the topics and ideas discussed here will be of universal value to anyone who creates anything at all. This podcast is all about offering a glimpse into the work we do as a bridge between clients and creatives. It's an ongoing exploration of how to wrangle the creative process to achieve excellence, no matter what the medium. Today, we are delighted to welcome all the way from New York, Grace Murray, Campaign Account Director at 4Card, one of the leading influencer marketing platforms in the world. From digging into website code to attending cocktail parties, we're going to discuss what goes on behind the curtain at one of the most emerging, confusing, controversial, and fascinating fields in our industry. But first, how is everyone going today? Lara, how are you?
I am well. This week is rushing by. It's, I don't know, Tuesday at 11 already, and I don't know how.
Bianca, what about you?
I mean, I'm excellent after almost 2 years living here in the US, apparently. I'm a football fan now, and my chosen team, the Philadelphia Eagles, won the playoffs last night, which means that they made it to the Super Bowl.
Tell us at least one thing you know about that team, Bianca.
Can we talk about this?
Silence, yeah.
I mean, I got to eat pretzels last night while I was watching the game, so that was pretty fantastic.
You know what? That's good. I'm into it.
I do want to come back and talk about the Philadelphia pamphlets at one stage, which is my favorite one of your sports excursions, but another time. This is a new year for us. This is all about lean podcasting, so I'm not going to get into it. So let's get straight into some of our links that have been going around our professional development Slack. Oh my God, we have such a big backlog to kind of work through. But one of the first things that I posted was an article from TechCrunch, which is about a new feature that Spotify is launching called Spotlight, which is a new podcast format with visual elements. And I think what I found interesting about this is that podcasts with visual elements is not something new at all. It's actually an ancient feature. I'll post a link to this article in terms of how Spotify is going to be doing it. And I think it's a really great thing. There are very simple ways that make kind of rich podcasts. And there is Marco Arment, who develops the Overcast app, which I listen to. He has come up with a new app called Forecast, which is for podcast hosts and companies where it makes it easier to put kind of images in there. And I was talking about Sheena with this the other day, like a lot of live podcasts as well that we love, like when you're listening to them and they're obviously showing things on stage, it's so annoying that you can't see them.
Oh, totally.
But also, like, you know, for a podcast like ours that is kind of very visual, it would be great. Like, you know, I have my phone on the stand or it's in the car or whatever, and while the podcast is playing and like you want to kind of see something, I think having that extra kind of element is definitely kind of ripe for
But that made it like illegal to listen to it while you're driving.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I'm not touching it.
I think you're supposed to watch the road.
Anyway,
I don't drive, so I don't know.
I think it's interesting to see Spotify starting to compete with companies like Audible in actually producing original content, especially in this medium. But I think for me, like apart from chapter, you know, being able to like kind of have chapter markers, which Audible already offers, I just like simply listening to things. So, I mean, Jeremy, I'm interested to see what maybe you want to do with our podcast, because that could be fun. But for me, I like just having my phone in my pocket.
Yeah,
and just
it's time to get away from the screen, but still feel stimulated.
Well, look, I just think it's interesting how this old kind of tech, I think, is going to kind of come back in a big way, especially like it would be great to kind of divide this, because I know different people when they listen to our podcast like to listen to different kind of segments. And also we are talking about visual kind of work, and it'd be great to kind of put that in there.
Oh, yeah.
So anyway, it'll be good to keep an eye on that, and I'll post that link up. Lara, you posted a link that has been in my open tabs for since the day it was launched, and about a million people sent it to me. Tell me what this is.
Yeah, so I mean, look, I posted this purely so I could talk about another link, really. So it's the New York Times 2017 Year in Illustration. So every year they do a sort of a recap of some of the most notable pieces that they've published in the Times over the year. And I mean, obviously the Times and many other sort of publications, mainly US ones, are known for using really, really beautiful, varied illustration. And I think this year was no exception. But the thing that the reason I really posted this was there was a follow-up piece posted on Subtraction, which I've never been on that site before. I don't know what Subtraction is.
Yeah, that's by Coy Vinh. He's the design director.
We have been on that site before. I do know what it is. All right then. But yeah, I mean, basically what he was looking at there was two sort of key elements. The first, which was in part of their review, they posted this amazing sort of tiled image of all of their Trump illustrations from the year. And obviously, I mean, Trump was a major, major, major topic over the last year, 2 years. And it was fascinating to see how different artists approach the same topic with such variation and different, not just in terms of like the actual methods of illustration they use, but just tones of voice. And yeah, it's really, really fascinating to see that sort of breadth of work. And then he basically compares that to, which is something we have mentioned a few times, over the last year, he has been collating screenshots of illustration usage in apps and websites and sort of related collateral on this sort of Pinterest board. And he's taking this snapshot and you can see that the range of expression is really, really narrow. The style of illustration is just the same. It's this flat vector, sort of minimally detailed characters, simple line work. And I guess what's really fascinating, he's not even saying that he like doesn't even like that illustration style, but it's so ubiquitous.
But you could say the same thing for like the New York Times illustrations as well, even though like they're so kind of varied, there's a definite kind of aesthetic there.
There's definitely an aesthetic. And I think, that's understandable. There's always going to be, there's going to be trends in sort of styles, visual styles, but there's definitely more, when you compare the two, it's insane. And I think like one of the really interesting points that he makes is that, what becomes quite clear is that a lot of these illustrations have probably been done by designers rather than illustrators, like the people who are actually sort of building the app. And you can sort of tell that by the style in that it's a style of work that only needs the same basic tools, the same tools that a designer might use in their daily work. And there's no sort of branching out into, other mediums of any sort.
Is this like the perfect instance where we need rich podcasting?
to actually show those, show what you mean. But yeah,
I guess all I can say is that I encourage people to go and look at the piece.
It's great. It's some great critical writing. And I mean, Coy is such a champion for illustration and he writes so wonderfully about it. So yeah, we'll put that up there. And B, rounding things off, the email charter. I saw this the other day that you posted and there was a particular point you wanted to highlight.
Well, I mean, this was a link, which is a little bit more sort of time management and project management focused, which comes from a tweet from the always wonderful Tina Roth Eisenberg, or Swiss Miss, as she's perhaps better known on the interwebs. And she writes, "Let's tell everyone about the email charter, especially number two, short or slow is not rude." And there's a link to this.
So what is the email charter, though? This is the first time I've
seen. Yeah, so the email charter, it was created in response to, I guess, like the widespread acknowledgement that we all have that email is getting out of hand for many people. And it's like one of, I guess, the biggest challenges that a lot of people face in their workday. And it started life as a blog post by two TED employees, a curator and a former scribe, but I guess was shaped by comments by thousands of people that sort of wrote in to give their own take on it. And it's really like behind the idea is that to fix a commons problem like email overload, a community needs to come together and agree to new rules. So it lists 10 rules, which are things like from respecting the recipient's time by taking the time yourself to minimize the time your email will take the recipient to process before you actually hit send, to slashing surplus CCs. And I mean, it's worth a read. But one of my favorites, which I've definitely tried to implement more over the last couple of years, is to quash open-ended questions. So this rule, I guess, argues that, I mean, this is like a very Jeremy thing, but it's like, it argues that you're asking a lot from someone when you send them a very long-winded email followed by the phrase thoughts or even
thoughts.
Yeah. Let me know how you can help. I mean, we've talked about like how heavy "let me know how I can help" is as a phrase. So
this is, you know, one of the changes that we've discussed that we're trying to make for the podcast this year is kind of, doing segments where we kind of go over these links in more detail. And like, I feel we could do an episode on each of these points. I mean, it is so, so good, but
can
it's
I
so
just say, I feel like some of it is contradictory in that, like, how are you meant to both like be comfortable with like being short and not necessarily like having like really, really deep thought about someone's email and just sort of sending something quick back, but then also, and also like taking a long time to respond, being like comfortable with that, and then also respecting their time and also making
it. Oh, it's impossible. It's impossible. This is why
they
I don't understand.
Exist together. Like that doesn't.
My big thing that I don't understand why it hasn't been like, I don't understand like why there's email hasn't gone to an audio format, like with everything that's happening in podcasting and everything happening in like kind of voice assistance. I would love it if my email was just like a walkie-talkie, or basically I could just kind of.
I would hate that.
No way. I would love it, because then you, at least you can get like a second dimension, not just kind of writing. You can get that kind
but
of.
But for
tone
most
across.
Of the emails I'm getting, I'm having to like. Go back, especially the kind of work that we do when you're negotiating with clients and figuring out little details of whatever the project is. I need to often go back and refer to that. And if I had to listen to a voice message every time, and
well,
find
that's when you get like transcribing and things like that.
You mark my words. This is gonna be something. Anyway, we will post this link. I want to come back and talk about this more, because it is really, really interesting. And yeah, I think there's a huge challenge, because I think a lot of these things are really necessary to do, and I think the email problem is real. But yeah, how we're gonna fix it. It's going to be tricky. Anyway, we'll post all the links in our show notes, as we do every week, on our web page for the podcast, which is jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. We also send it out in a podcast-specific newsletter every Friday, which you can sign up to at tinyletter.com/jackiewinter. Thanks, everyone. We first discussed influencer marketing back in September, as we investigated some of the more basic workings of things from our perspective as more traditional agents and producers. Since then, influencer marketing has only grown in scale and ambition. So to help fill out the bigger picture of the ins and outs of this rapidly changing industry, we're very excited to welcome Grace Murray to the podcast. Grace is a campaign account director for 4Card in New York, one of the largest influencer agencies / platforms in the market. Grace, welcome to the podcast.
Thank
How are you?
You very much. I'm great, Jeremy. Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. Another Australian in New York. Who would have thunk it?
Exactly. We're rapidly taking over. Jinx.
That was the plan all along, wasn't it?
It was. It is. It's definitely the plan. We all have secret meetings about it.
How did you kind of end up in New York from your hometown of Sydney, I believe? Is that correct?
I'm actually originally from Newcastle. So I basically studied in Newcastle, studied communications, doing a mix of kind of PR and journalism. And then was working in an agency there, and kind of, you know, as most disenfranchised students fresh out of uni, was kind of feeling like there might have been a little bit more to kind of sink my teeth into. And a good friend of mine had recently moved to New York and was kind of doing all of these cool things and giving us all of these updates of amazing people that she'd met and cool projects that she was working on. So initially I just kind of, a lot of people say that it was brave, but it was more, you know, a little bit of boredom really that I wanted to kind of, I sort of felt like a time to hit the gap and come over and make a go of it. So that was the initial draw.
So tell us a bit more about what you're doing now. So you've been at 4Card since their inception in 2014, which is, I think in current kind of work and influencer timelines is an eternity.
Yeah, absolutely. So basically I came over to New York with the intention of kind of finding interesting people to work for and with, but didn't really have any kind of specific idea of what that job could look like. I'd worked in an agency and full service ad agency in Australia in an account service role there, but wanted to kind of explore what else was out there. So moved to New York, didn't have a job, had a J-1 visa, which is pretty restrictive, but basically was Airbnb-ing actually in Williamsburg, which is where most of the Australians head to, and could kind of see there were these two guys next door who just kept filtering in and out of the apartment and seemed to be living a lot larger next door than we were. We were in this apartment that had been kind of sliced and diced into four different bedrooms, and we could see from their open door that theirs was this huge big open space, and there were desks in there, and one of them was wearing a Kenzo sweater all the time, and one of them had really cool hair, and there was this beautiful dog. So we were trying to, you know, we were thinking, this is my friend and I who'd moved over together, and we were just thinking, you know, who are these guys? What are they doing? They're clearly working in something creative and doing pretty well, it seems like. So we should try and, you know, forge our way into their lives and try and jump on the bandwagon. So that's kind of how it started. I really had no interest in influencer marketing specifically, but was in account management in advertising previously, and again moved to New York to find interesting people to work with and learn from. At that point, really only for a year-long period, but here I am 4 years later.
So those people just happened to live next door.
They did, yeah. So it's a pretty pretty crazy kind of, I know, exactly. And yeah, we literally knocked on the door and used the dog as a ruse to kind of make friends and figure out what they were doing. So took the dog for a walk, ended up asking if they wanted to get a drink, then started rapidly fishing around for what they were doing in there. And they kind of gave us the top line explanation of how it all worked. But it was literally, you know, the two co-founders and a web developer at that stage working out of an apartment. So, you know, we were interested and intrigued, but then started asking more about the clients and, you know, the types of work they were doing, and started to rattle off a few clients like Oscar de la Renta and Chanel. And we're like, okay, now we're really listening. Like, what is going on in there? And we essentially offered to work for them for free because we had no jobs, no friends, really, no prospects. So we figured we'd be able to get a, at the very least, an intro or a recommendation from them into an actual paying job eventually, but ended up kind of sticking around like a bad smell, and they gave us a job. So here we are 4 years later. We're still both working for the company now. So,
4 years later, what is Forecard? What does it do?
Yeah, so Forecard is an influencer marketing platform. So at the moment, I think we just ticked over to 35,000 influencers who are on Forecard. So basically that means that when they become a part of our community, they connect their social accounts. And then from there, we can get an amazing amount of data on them. So we can see who their audience demographics are. We actually launched something last year that can determine whether or not they've ever purchased any followers, which has been huge for us. We can, you know, have a complete content record of everything that they've ever spoken to. So, you know, if we're working with a new brand, we can see if they've referenced that brand before. If it's a specific interest area, we could be identifying people based on, you know, a niche interest that they might have. So instead of, the idea is essentially that we can partner with brands and influencers to be able to bring them together in ways that are more strategic and more creative and backed in actual data than just kind of saying, you know, here's a girl who looks great on Instagram, who has a couple of 100,000 followers, who's promoting your fit tea or something like that. So it's we like to think it's a lot more involved and that there's a lot more to it. And at the moment now, you know, 4 years later, we have over 200 clients. We've moved out of the apartment and into an actual office in Soho, and we have, I think, 20 employees now. So it's definitely all grown since the humble days of the Williamsburg apartment, that's for sure.
And so how does it actually fit with all the other kind of businesses that have sprung up in the last few years that are kind of, you know, that are in this kind of sphere?
A big difference for us is that technically we don't actually represent any of the influencers. So unlike a talent agency where we're kind of having those one-to-one relationships with absolutely everyone, we're kind of more consciously taking a little bit of a step back from that and instead working with some people who are represented, some people who aren't. We actually just recently worked with NetJets, which was crazy, and NetJets, a private jet company. So they say, okay, we are a private jet company. We're trying to reach a younger audience. This is the type of look and feel we want. This is the type of demographics that we want to speak to. And this is for an activation. So instead of just posting, we need them to be kind of client-friendly, professional, on time, all those sorts of things. So in those instances, we can use kind of a combination of the technology that we have at our hands to be able to see those audience demographics and the brands that they're speaking to and their content history, their growth rates, all that sort of stuff. But we also then lean on the fact that we have personal one-to-one relationships with a really high volume of these people. So it's particularly ones that are in, you know, the New York and LA markets that we're working with super frequently. While we're not representing them, the dynamic of that relationship is quite similar in that we are kind of the in-between the client and the influencer or the creator. We're briefing them, we're bringing them offers, we're managing the contract process. But from the client side, part of the value is essentially that we aren't necessarily just representing our pool of talent. So we're bringing them the recommendations of who we think are the best fit, regardless of where they are or who their agent is. So again, they could have an agent, or they may not. They may be self-represented. So we kind of run the gamut there.
And do you think, I mean, 35,000 on your platform, and of course, thousands and thousands and thousands outside of it. Do you think there's a case to be made that there are too many influencers? I mean, what does that do to the market? Yes. and to us as a society?
Short answer is probably yes. There are, you know, I feel like we're in a bit of a phase at the moment, or a bit of a stage in the world where everyone's wondering what makes an influencer, and, you know, can we all be an influencer?
Like, I remember in high school when every guy decided he was a DJ.
Oh my God, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting. I think one of the most common things that I hear in meetings is, you know, oh, I should have just become an influencer. And I can understand it, but I also tend to sit there and think, well, why didn't you? Like, why are we all sitting here, you know, discussing how much to pay some of these people? And there's obviously so many. I think the beauty of having so many people with a following, and that term influencer is becoming so catch-all in the last couple of years, but in terms of having so many people with a following, I think the beauty of it becomes that brands no longer have to only go to, you know, Leandra from Man Repeller or Nicole from Gary Pepper Vintage or, you know, any of those kind of heavy hitters. They're all amazing and they all do an incredible job, but they're not right for every brand. And if every brand is to work with them, then the share of voice that that brand gets is completely diluted. So if instead of that, you have this huge pool of people who might only have a couple of thousand followers, but, you know, speak to scuba diving, or they speak to, like we had a request recently for LA-based influencers who normally talk about beauty products but are also scuba certified, because our client was running a scuba trip, and with the technology that we have, we're able to search scuba and apply a beauty filter and be able to find people who have already spoken about those two things. So I think ultimately it does afford brands the opportunity to work with people who sincerely are right for their brand, instead of just thinking, okay, this person has this amount of followers, you know, that's all we're after, and kind of treating them as like a traditional ad buy, because that isn't necessarily always how it works best.
I just find it so interesting, you know, that essentially we've taken what is this like very, very basic human attribute of people seeing something that's cool or interesting or beautiful and wanting to be cool or interesting or beautiful, just like those people. And we've sort of turned it into a business, which makes complete sense in today's climate. But it's interesting to see something that is so sort of like messy and organic and human turn into something that can be so, I guess, like datafied. Is that the word? It's a word now.
Yeah, absolutely. I think something that is interesting, or from my side of seeing some of these deals go through, is that it would be unbelievable to the layman to see the types of deals that people do turn down just because they don't feel like it's a fit. You know, the types of, a lot of the time as well, clients will ask, how much does it cost to work with this person, or how much does it cost to work with this person? And I think from a traditional agent's perspective, that gets really tough with influencers, because, and I'm assuming, I haven't actually worked too much in with artists directly, but I'm assuming this is the case across the board, in that the cost can drastically vary depending on how stoked the person would be to work with that brand. So there's one girl that last year we sent one deal for a mass lingerie brand to, and that was for, I think off the top of my head, somewhere around the 10K mark, and then another for a cooler underwear brand that was unpaid, but it was, you know, they were going to regram her post and it was more about being aligned with them. And she declined the 10K one, but did the free one because she just wanted to be associated with that brand. So there's, you know, absolutely a case to be made for not everything just being pay to play, because it does become very, it can become pretty stale pretty quickly if it's done poorly. And that's exactly what we're trying to kind of avoid by building out technology that allows us to operate at scale, but in ways that are still ultimately content that feels human and feels relevant to the person producing it.
Because it's such a funny business in that, like, it relies so heavily on people feeling that the material is authentic. And someone's only an influencer if people are, you know, influenced by them and if they trust their opinion. And you only trust someone's opinion if you think it's actually honest. And so it's such a funny thing to balance, I imagine, between, you know, making it feel honest and like a genuine connection, like a proper, you know, an influencer that actually fits well with that brand, but in the same time, it also is being paid for. You were saying how, you know, there's people that turn stuff down, turn offers down. And like, I have influencers, I guess, that I really love and I really, really trust. And I actually quite like their paid content because I know that they will turn down ones that they don't believe in. And so when they do take one on, I actually am like, okay, this actually must be a good product, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And we kind of provide counsel here and there on, you know, two brands on how to approach, the level of transparency that people have with their brand partnerships, because there are some brands that, you know, in this day and age, it is required if an influencer is being paid that they have to disclose that to their audience. So, you know, in some instances, it is better to kind of position something as really overt, as a like, almost as if you are a spokesperson for that brand and say that I'm so excited to be working with this brand in a larger capacity. I'm going to be doing all this content for them, or I'm going to be working on a bunch of different projects. Because if it's approached in that way from certain types of brands, that feels more authentic and more like a positive thing to the audience than them just saying, you know, oh, here I am, I love my Old Navy sweater, and then just having a little hashtag ad at the end. That works in some cases, because if that content is relevant to the audience, it doesn't necessarily cause a negative, you know, sentiment. But if it's something that feels a little bit like it's left of center of what they'd typically speak about, we usually recommend that, you know, we brief the influencers in a way that's super like, hey, here I am doing a partnership with this brand. I'm really excited about it. It's a really good thing for me. And as my audience and someone who has followed along with my journey and my career, hopefully you're excited about that too, is kind of the
going
tone.
Going back to pricing, Grace, considering, I mean, you are working with such a broad range of clients, and then also the influencers that you're working with, you know, kind of range from micro influencers that might only have a few thousand followers to some of like the heavy hitters that have hundreds of thousands of followers. And I mean, this influencer world is such a new industry. Are there sort of pricing standards?
For sure. So, I mean, short answer is that you can just come and speak to us at Fullcut. A big benefit, in all honesty, is that we've been around for a couple of years now, which honestly is quite rare in this space, because I feel like there's a new company popping up every day that's some derivative of like influencer or social influencer platform. Like, there's so many popping up that it's difficult. But a big kind of value proposition of the way that we work is that we have such a huge historical record of payouts that we've made to influencers. So over the past couple of years, there's been millions of dollars.
Sorry to interrupt, but you guys, are you a commission-based business or?
No. So the way that we work is the pricing piece of it's actually a big part of kind of the value that we bring to the clients. So rather than being like an agent where we are earning the commission, it instead is kind of flipped. So an agent will come to us, or sorry, a brand will come to us at the beginning and say, you know, hey, I have 50K, 100K, whatever it might be. I want to work on Instagram, or maybe I want blog posts. I need usage for these specific things. These are our KPIs. This is what we're looking to do. And these are the types of people that I want to work with. And then we can come back to them, and based on this huge bank of historical data on, you know, the millions of dollars that have gone through our system over the past 4 years, we know, like a media planner, we know that YouTube's more expensive than Instagram, for example, and we know the average cost per 1,000 followers that we've paid out on YouTube versus Instagram. We know that Twitter is a lot cheaper than both of those two things. And we know that if we're adjusting the usage to be beyond just the rights to repost, that can affect things as well. So then from the very beginning, we can come back to the client and say, okay, for your budget and your KPIs and what you're wanting to do, we can guarantee that you can get 1 million impressions, and that can either be comprised of 5 people at this follower level, each posting once, or 10 people at this follower level, each posting once. So we can kind of provide options of how that works.
So it's almost sense, like
it sounds very similar to what, you know, we kind of do.
Well, but no, it's almost kind of like, I mean, I don't want this to come off as kind of too cynical, but like, it's almost like kind of you're almost like an ad agency, but you're not producing the creative, but the influencers are kind of like the media space in a way. Like, instead of picking, okay, we want to go to this billboard because it's in this location where these people go, you can target it much more, you know, much more precisely in terms. Yeah.
And I think, and honestly, you know, you can say I've heard every cynical thing, so there's much worse that's been said.
Hey, we work in advertising.
I wouldn't worry, Jeremy. Yeah, no, totally. So it honestly, it is definitely a direct comp in terms of how we think about it. And I think less about, that's not necessarily to make this super nuts and bolts and turnkey and completely disregard all the creative elements of it. It is more because honestly, there isn't a huge standard in this industry. And I think that's a big thing that we're trying to bring to the table, not to make things just dry and you know,
oh, totally. Super it's clean. A completely valid career now to be an influencer, and there needs to be a way to standardize how you make money and how you find clients. And yeah, it makes
totally
complete sense.
And you know, to be able to validate the whole industry and allow brands to even to be able to plan their spend and say, okay, I know at least even roughly what I could get. Because so often, being that we are still gathering these costs and we have a good idea of what we think they should be, so often a cost will come back and it'll be 15, 20 times higher than what we think it should be. And ultimately, there's some brands out there that are paying that. So we never necessarily say to a brand, oh, you're not working with that person, they're too expensive, but we would definitely recommend not doing that and using the data that we have to go back to that person and say, hey, we think you're overcharging for these reasons. So of course, sometimes the brand is in love with a specific person, they're happy to pay higher than what we see as market rate, but we kind of act as that counsel there for them.
Interesting. I'm just kind of curious about your role in particular. I mean, I know Orbianca was saying that, you know, a recent campaign involved a private jet and an exotic location. So there's a lot of the interpersonal aspects, but then also the platform itself is backed by some pretty intense tech as well, that I assume. So how do those kind of two things balance out, I mean, for your role and specifically in your studio?
Yeah, totally. So we do have two sides of the business. So there's a subscription side, which is kind of self-serve. You jump in, you do everything yourself, find everyone, and manage the relationship directly, which is leaning on all of the tech. And then we do have managed campaigns as well. So I'm kind of leading the charge on the campaign side of the business at 4Card. And historically, that was me both bringing in the business and then actually executing the campaigns as well. Since we've grown a lot over the last couple of years, we've now got built out both of those teams. So we have new business and execution. But on the execution side, sometimes the campaigns are super turnkey where it's social only. You know, the influencers are responsible for creating their own content and it's all done over the phone and email. But then for the activation pieces, like the fun one that you've referenced, was one of the luckier campaigns that we've been able to work on, which was, again, with NetJets, where they wanted us to actually manage an activation on their behalf. So, again, we're still kind of using the technology to be making our recommendations of who we think is a fit, but ultimately so many brands are still wanting these campaigns to be outsourced because it's a new industry. Sometimes people don't really know the rules. Sometimes it could just be a manpower thing. But in the case with NetJets, they very much wanted myself and our CEO, James, who very handily doubles as a photographer, but they wanted us there along for the ride to kind of help manage and facilitate the experiences, help them grow the relationships with the influencers on the trip. So they're all people that we'd worked with previously. So yeah, we're lucky enough to not only pick the people, contract them, help with some of the hotel partnerships and kind of getting everything in place in that way, but then actually heading along to manage on site. So really rough week last week in the Cayman Islands.
No, it's so funny because this morning my housemate was asking me, you know, oh, who are you talking to on the podcast today? And I was saying, you know, oh, Grace Murray. And I'm like, oh my God, she was on a private jet to the Cayman Islands last week. What is her life? And my housemate goes, oh yeah, the Cayman cookout. And I was like, what? And she was like, yeah, I saw this. She was like, someone she follows on Instagram was like flying on a private. She's like, yeah, NetJets. And I was like, what? How do you? Oh, it works.
exactly. And honestly, it honestly catches me by surprise sometimes because I'll look at a report that we do and say, oh yeah, client, here you go. Here's, you know, 20 million impressions for this campaign. Here's the PDF. Here's the web report or whatever. And you forget, you know, that those are real people who are seeing that and whose perceptions being changed, or who are having some kind of level of exposure to the brand that you're promoting or the product that you're promoting. So it's exciting when someone like has seen it already and is familiar with what it was. So it's cool. It does work, funnily enough.
So I guess in summary, as someone who's been in the industry for a while, what do you think are some key takeaways you could give either someone who wants to add being an influencer to their kind of bag of tricks, or other account managers or people who are kind of being thrown into actually having to manage influencers in these kind of jobs? Is there any kind of specific bits of wisdom that, you know, you'd like to leave our audience with?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think on the wanting to be an influencer side, I think it's important to remember that if everyone could be an influencer, I think having seen some of the lifestyles that some of them lead, that everyone probably would be one.
I just want free makeup.
Exactly. Yeah. Don't we all? I think it's one of those things that, you know, people do forget that despite it seeming unfair, it seeming like this super easy job that they don't ever have to do anything, that's very truly not the case. And even if someone kind of stumbled into the role that they're now in, role being having a huge audience, it isn't something that can just be, you know, built overnight. And it is something that ultimately is valuable to brands and that is an incredibly valuable asset to have. So definitely, you know, if that's your dream and you want to be an influencer as a catch-all term, there's lots of different things that you can do, but I would just caution by saying it is a very crowded marketplace and it's harder than ever to break into because so many more people are trying because they can see the benefits. So unless you really love creating content and speaking to an audience every day, I wouldn't recommend it. And then on the kind of managing influencer side and therefore managing campaigns that are, you know, involving clients, I think a key thing that we always say on our team is that often just because something isn't your fault, it doesn't mean it's not your responsibility. So often a case that you'll be put in, and this is true not only for working with influencers, but working with any kind of, in any kind of project management role, you are often the deliverer of bad news, whether that is something that you could have planned for or not. So being able to kind of, a term that someone gave me once on a campaign activation managing a crazed cameraman was that I was acting like human champagne because, you know, I think that is such a huge part that is very difficult to teach of any kind of account manager or producer's role, of being able to make someone feel heard, make someone feel like you're understanding where they're coming from, but ultimately still get them to do what you need them to do. So working with influencers, I think, is very true of that, in that a deadline could be missed or content might not come through on time. And ultimately, you still have to keep that person going and feeling like they want to meet, even if it is a push deadline, and at the same time, be keeping the client feeling like you're doing everything that you can and that everything will eventually be okay, that this too shall pass. So I'd say that's two little takeaways there.
There are so many crossovers between what you do and what we do. I think we could chat for forever. Grace, thank you so much for joining us. If anyone wants to find you, where can they find you online?
Absolutely. So they can find me on Instagram. Hopefully I'm managing some other activation elsewhere and I'll be smugly reporting it. So on Instagram, I'm at Grace Murray. Email, you can get me at grace@forcard, F-O-H-R-C-A-R-D. And yeah, those are the two really.
Thank you so much, Grace. Really appreciate it. Good luck with everything this year. And yeah, look forward to hearing more about your adventures on Instagram and everywhere else.
I'm not. I'm jealous.
I'm smart.
But thank you, Grace.
Closing, as we like to do every week, is the most Melbourne and the most New York thing we have experienced. Laura, let's start with you. What is the most Melbourne thing that's happened to you the last week?
Mine is just I guess, a bit of a gripe again.
We really do need to kind of change, I think, the title for this, because they are mostly
gripes.
This
is a Melbourne thing. It's okay. Just a Melbourne gripe.
Please.
Well, actually, they might have them in other places, but it feels very Melbourne to me. I used an Exaloo this week.
Exaloo?
You know what an Exaloo is, right? Uh-huh. The the automatic toilets.
Oh my God, I love these so much.
The automatic public toilets.
They're so good. And they clean
I like
it.
The concept. They clean themselves. It's great. It's good to have public toilets to clean themselves. But I am mad that I moved to Melbourne when I was six, and the entire time I've been here, they've played the exact same song. You walk in and it goes, "Welcome to Exaloo. Your maximum use time is 10 minutes. Press button to unlock door." And then is it Evergreen that starts playing?
What?
Oh, no, it's "What the World Needs Now is Love."
Oh, no.
But it's like this soft jazz piano version. And then if you stay in there long enough, it turns to Evergreen.
Evergreen?
Yeah, I can't sing it. I'm not going to sing it. But
someone got a sweet licensing cut off that deal.
I know, right? And I don't know. It's just, it's been like a really, really long time. And I feel like they should change. It's been like 20 years and probably longer. And they just, they should change the music.
This is yes. This is a huge thing I had against Westpac, the bank that we use, because they're weird jazz funk hold music, which they've actually kind of changed, but I'm so close to starting a petition.
I see. It's one through cabs. Before Uber, round the block, one through cabs, before when you had to sit on the line for like 40 minutes to get a cab on a Saturday night.
Sorry, Laura, I don't want to go into this now, but I'm actually surprised you didn't bring up that you got a sick Bunnings hat. Last week.
That is the most Melbourne thing. I did. I bought a Bunnings cap. It was $3.
Get me one.
Dan, my boyfriend, is very unhappy about it. I think it's beautiful.
I'll totally take it. B, most New York thing for you?
Well, again, I just love how accessible everything is in New York. I saw The Disaster Artist on like Wednesday, and then by Sunday, I then went and saw The Room with Tommy Wiseau in person. It was amazing. So that was my most New York thing. Wiseau, whatever. But yeah.
He was there?
Yeah.
In The Room?
Yeah, he was in The Room.
See, I'm mad because my Melbourne thing is always me complaining about something shit, and your New York thing is always you being like, "How awesome is New York?"
It's been bloody cold, so I don't know. Never get over that.
Yeah, well, my thing is just that it's still like school holidays and there's been no traffic coming to work, which has just been so good. It's like vintage Melbourne. That's what I love about it, just kind of coming in.
Melbourne in the 50s.
Exactly.
Except there's women at work.
Lots of them, actually. Okay, I think we'll end it there. Thank you so much, Laura.
Thank you.
Thanks, B.
Thank you both.
This has been Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. Jackie Winter Gives You the Business is a weekly podcast about creative project management and production and just making things happen in general. Our producer is Arij Norm. You can find the Jackie Winter Group on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, etc. at Jackie Winter. That's Jackie with a Y and Winter like the season. And you can email us with any recommendations, feedback, questions, or comments at podcast@jackiewinter.com. Archives of all of our shows and show notes can be found at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. Our theme music is by Melbourne-based musician Jackie Winter. You can check out his stuff on soundcloud.com/Jackie Winter. If you love what you hear, you can help us out by subscribing on iTunes, rating us, and commenting too. Details are on our website at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. You can also sign up to our podcast-specific newsletter at tinyletter.com/Jackie Winter to be notified of new episodes every Friday, along with all of the show notes and other things we chat about. Thanks for listening. Catch you next week. Bye-bye. Yeah. She thinks I'm in the game because I'm out of brain when she hears me sing. And so she holds a